Hello and welcome to the opening bell. My name is Matt Christie and I'm joined by John Denon as per usual. John, how are you?
I'm all right. I'm not the one who's just been to Las Vegas.
I'm jet lagged out of my face.
It's a euphemism for drunk, by the way.
I wish. But no, it's really today where I've really started, where I've felt tired, but you know, I'm sure I'll get over it. But yeah, no, it was a long and thoroughly enjoyable week. I thought Khan fought exceptionally well until the point he got knocked out, and I suppose it's the repercussions of that knockout in terms of Khan's future, which for us is one of the biggest talking points of the fight.
It was a bad knockout, I thought. Like, I think we predicted Canelo was going to win inside the distance, but I wasn't expecting it to be quite such a sort of sickening blow. Like, the way Khan felt on the way he sort of, you know, his head hit the canvas, you know, even Canelo sort of knelt over him to see if he was all right. That seemed... that seems like it's something that's going to be very, very hard to come back from. It sort of reminded people of Manny Pacquiao knocking out Ricky Hatton. I don't think Hatton was really the same after that, was he? It didn't look good.
No, I think we were lucky enough to go and see Khan just hours later, really. It was the next morning after the fight, and he didn't look like he'd been in a fight. There was a small graze below his eye, but he was kind of holding court very jovially, laughed off suggestions that retirement was an option, and I'm sure he did feel fine the next day. It's kind of the you mentioned there, Ricky Hatton. I suppose you could argue that was psychological, in that he'd fought Mayweather and Pacquiao and realised that he was never going to quite reach the very, very top of boxing, which was always an ambition of his, and he may have struggled with that. But you go through history and you look at some of the most vicious knockouts that you could compare to that. If you look at, I don't know, say Rocky Marciano, Jerzy Joe Walcott was never the same. If you want someone who was fairly young at the time of taking the knockout, if you look at John Tate, when he lost his heavyweight title to Mike Weaver, he was never the same after that. Wilfred Benitez, when he knocked out Maurice Hope wasn't really the same. These kind of eye-catching, spectacular knockouts, although it's not the case for every knockout victim, it is very, very hard to come back from, even though I 100% believe that Khan thinks that he's going to be as good as new in his next fight. So time will tell, but I would just like to see Khan. I mean, he's saying he's going to come back in December. I'd almost like to see him take the whole year off.
Yeah. Yeah.
And come back maybe this time next year.
Isn't that something Manny Stewart said to you once?
Yeah.
You know, after a bad knockout, a fighter ought to take like a year off.
A year out. Because even if he comes back in December and you're thinking, well, you know, that's 6 months down the line, there's still going to be sparring and what have you and everything else going on before that. So I'd like to see that happen, but he did seem adamant. His team seemed adamant. And when I say his team, Virgil Hunter wasn't there, so I'm not sure if Virgil will have anything to do with it. But like his team and his family, or his father and his brothers, were kind of adamant that he would be.
But then his mother doesn't even watch him fight, because she can't bear watching the chance of him getting hurt. So I imagine it must be sort of, you know, it must be terrible for her. Like, I guess she didn't watch the fight, but she would have.
Exactly, and she was. She didn't watch the fight. She doesn't watch his fights anymore, because she obviously doesn't want to see a son get hurt, which I can certainly empathise with to an extent. But you know, there's something quite interesting that he said afterwards, in that he's been promising his mom that he would retire after two or three fights, and he's been saying that for about his last six or seven fights.
Right.
And you know, he was saying it with a smile, and he was saying that something else that was fairly amusing was that he was flying back. I think he's flying back was flying back a couple of days after he spoke to us, and he's saying, "Oh, my mom's going to be sat next to me on the flight back, and all the way she's going to be harassing me to retire." But you could understand that. You can understand it completely. And I remember when Amir Khan first, you know, turned professional after his Olympic medal in 2004, and he turned professional a year later. And when it looked like he was going to reach the top, his end game was like, right, when I get to the age of 27, 28, I'm going to have millions of pounds in the bank, and I'm off. Yeah. And you could say that he's kind of, he's achieved that.
Mission accomplished now.
Yeah. But you still feel with Amir Khan, as with a lot of these guys who are tantalisingly close to the very, very top, to the pound for pound kind of level, they want to see that they want to get there. They want to get there, and you can make a case that for five rounds, Amir Khan was beating Canelo Alvarez, who's arguably the biggest star in the world in boxing at the moment, worldwide.
Yeah.
So you can understand it, and his memory of the fight will be, I was winning. At the end, I think it was the end of the fourth round, he went back and he was really, really pleased with himself, and he had every right to be.
But isn't it worrying that as soon as Canelo actually started catching him and actually started finding his range, as soon as he started hitting Amir, it started hurting him? And do you think with hindsight, letting a welterweight go leap straight up into a normal, you know, middleweight world title fight was a bad idea?
Yeah,
should the fight even have happened?
You can make that argument, and there were one or two making that argument afterwards. In that, you know, Khan was almost exploited in a way. His ambition was exploited to make Canelo Alvarez look good in a fight they knew that he would win.
Yeah.
And he would ultimately be too strong. I think the nature of the knockout proved that it was kind of a badly matched fight. I don't like to use the word mismatch, because when a fighter's won four out of five completed rounds, you couldn't say it was a mismatch against him. But yeah, you can certainly make the case that by jumping from welterweight up to effectively middleweight, and bearing in mind he spent most of his career at super lightweight as well, 140 pounds, there is an argument for that. Khan, that question was put to Khan, he kind of admitted that, okay, right, now I just need to be sensible, I just need to stick at welterweight. But he did say, you know, he'd take it on too much, he wouldn't do it again, and he shouldn't have taken the jump, but he didn't regret it at the same time. And I think if he was to take him back in time to this time last week or whenever, even if he had a knowledge of what was going to happen in the fight, he'd go through with the fight again. Khan was desperate for that opportunity. But, you know, it's easy to say it was oh so predictable, because we were all, you know, the vast majority of people were predicting that. There was the odd person that was saying Khan might be able to just do it over 12 rounds. But it was a fight that Amir Khan wanted. I suppose what you're saying is then it comes in, well, do some of these guys need to be rescued from themselves?
Yeah, that's right. It's hard for me to say, because, you know, before the fight I was intrigued by it. I thought it was an exciting fight, but it was just how... I did think Khan would get knocked out, but I wasn't saying this shouldn't be happening. But it was once I saw the knockout and how bad it was, then that made me think twice about it all. And should Amir Khan have had had an advisor saying, yeah, I know you're gonna make a lot of money out of this, but in the long term, this is not a good idea. And in Amir Khan, he can make a... You know, yeah, he might not have been able to make as much money out of one single fight, but he could have had two or three fights to make a, you know, comparable haul.
Yeah,
I think those are the questions now. That
yeah, I completely hear you. I know what you're saying, and also there's the fact that I think something that struck me in the week, and I think I put something about it on the website, just an observation, was that. Obviously, the other thing which we'll talk about a little bit later on is the whole, you know, spectre of Gennady Golovkin and he wasn't just hanging over the post fight. He was all over fight week in terms of pretty much every other question. Even directed at Khan was about Gennady Golovkin. But Canelo, I don't know if he's kind of, for want of a better word, kind of before the fight was kind of programmed to dismiss Golovkin and just focus on Amir Khan, but he said something along the lines of, well, you know, what Golovkin's doing, he doesn't deserve to fight me. He doesn't deserve it fighting the likes of Dominic Wade, doesn't get a fight with Canelo, while completely ignoring the fact that Amir Khan never even fought in the middleweight division, much less held a title there for 6 years. So yeah, there is the other argument that perhaps you could have put it to the WBC. You know, why is Khan, who has never fought in the light middleweight division, being allowed to jump up to middleweight and fight the middleweight champion there without having any kind of pedigree at the higher weight, and we don't know how he'll cope with it. So there are questions to be asked there, but at the same time, you go back and you look through boxing history, and you know it's very common for a fighter to go up or down in weight and challenge a champion in a weight class they've got no experience of. But it is, you know, certainly something that should be investigated further in light of the savagery of the knockout. I mean, but what did you think of Khan's performance prior to the stoppage?
Yeah, he was boxing well. You know, he should have been up on the cards, shouldn't he? That's the thing that's going to be get forgotten about with the with the focus of the knockout like we've been talking. But the judge, like only one of the judges, has had him ahead at the time, didn't they?
Yeah, you could make a case, but I think one judge had him 3-2 up. You could make a case for that. I had him 4-1 up. But what with kind of live blogging and everything, I don't like to kind of say that's like any official tally or anything else. So I did make sure, and I spoke to a lot of people, and the worst score that I found in regards to Khan, and this is speaking to Mexican journalists, to American journalists and British journalists, was 3-2 to Amir Khan after five rounds. Pretty much everybody I spoke to, in fact everybody I spoke to without fail, had Amir Khan winning. But the one judge that had Canelo 4-1 up just makes the mind boggle.
Yeah.
Absolutely makes the mind boggle.
Yeah, because let's say Khan had been able to keep it up and not get tagged, then they were never giving it to him on the cards the way the scoring was going after the first five rounds.
I mean, there's quite an extensive report on it, and in the report it does go into detail about the build-up, about the weigh-in, about the fight itself as well. And then there's quite a lot in the report about the aftermath. And one of the things, you know, I put that question to Khan about, you know, what did you make of the judges? And his response, to summarise, was, well, I'm almost glad I got knocked out, because it would have been absolutely heartbreaking to go 12 rounds and then find that I'd been robbed on the cards.
Yeah.
And given the way that Khan was fighting for those five rounds, and okay, it was a tough ask for him to do it for another seven, but it would suggest that he was not going to get the because he couldn't have done any more than he was doing over the last seven, and if they hadn't rewarded him for what he'd done in the first five, then they sure as hell wouldn't have done for the last seven. So yeah, that is something. That's certainly something. And what about going forward now, if your head was on the block, do you believe that Canelo and Golovkin will get together in September?
I don't feel like it's going to be September.
Next year, next May?
Yeah. I think it's got to happen eventually. But from the sounds Canelo's promoter was making beforehand, doesn't seem like they're in a desperate rush to make Canelo Golovkin right now. But then I don't know what would happen with the WBC title. Because if it's not, like, could they agree to fight in 2017 with tune-up fights beforehand? Would the WBC allow that? I don't know.
I would say, I mean, they've got an agreement, haven't they, with the WBC, both camps, that they need to thrash out a deal within 15 days of the fight.
Yeah, or it goes to Perth.
I suspect if they have, given that Golovkin is, even though he's got the other titles, he's like the mandatory, isn't he?
Yeah.
I would say that if they have agreed a date, then it will be okay. But you can't really agree a date and a venue and everything. You can't do that if you've got another fight in the pipeline.
Yeah, but like, that's what Andre Ward and Sergey Kovalev have done.
But they've got the venue and everything sorted out.
No, but I guess they've got an agreement to fight in whenever it is, November or something.
Yeah, but so
because the problem is, if the WBC strip Canelo, it would never get made as Canelo challenging Golovkin, because Canelo would want the sort of
exactly
lion's share of the deal, and I think at least parity, but probably.
I think Mauricio Sulaiman as well. He's, you know, this is the fight that he wants for the sport, and he, you know, regards to, I mean, going back as far as like Cotto Canelo in November, he was like, this is what it's leading to, everything is leading to, you know, the winner of this fight in Golovkin. So I think that he would show leniency if he was certain that fight was going to happen.
I'm also
in the
certain,
foreseeable.
I'm also certain that HBO want it.
Yeah, yeah.
So there shouldn't be any of the sort of Mayweather-Pacquiao network wars to contend with.
I think the biggest stumbling block, or it seemed to me what the biggest stumbling block would be was this whole catchweight nonsense.
Yeah.
In that, I think Golovkin has said, "Look, I'm not coming down to 155." And why should he?
Yeah. And also, you know what? You know, if Canelo was on his way to Golovkin, why is he fighting at 155 against a welterweight? You know, doesn't he need, realistically, he needs to have a fight at 160 pounds to get ready to fight Golovkin?
Of course he does, and it's not as if he doesn't look like, I mean, he looked like, and it may have been the contrast, even though they both weighed the same on the weigh-in, they both weighed 155, the contrast in their bodies, just, again, it was just obvious that they were from different weight classes. Khan, you know, traditionally is always been, you know, very, he's been cut, and he just not, I suppose love handles is too strong a term, but he was a bit wobbly in certain places that you don't expect Amir Khan to be, whereas Alvarez looked like he'd just been boiled down to get to 155. There's absolutely no question in my mind that I think he'd probably be better off just being at 160. He looks like a middleweight.
Yeah.
He looks like he should be at 160. Now, there was no official word on the night, which again is always a little bit concerning. There was no official word on the night about what they both weighed going in. I suspect because the difference was a little bit worrying. That's me. That's just me. That's a suspicion.
Yeah, and in the ring, he just looked bigger.
And if you look at the photographs, you look at all the photographs in kind of the how thick their bodies were.
Yeah.
Alvarez was a much bigger fighter, but Khan believed that he himself was up to 162 on the night, and he thought Alvarez was something like 180. Which, if he's going from 155, you know, surely he can come in at 160.
Yeah.
And you know there's the cynic in you thinks, well, is he kind of staying at this 155 kind of thing to make it difficult for the Golovkin fight to happen, or the Golovkin fight to happen immediately. I don't know. There was something there, even though De La Hoya was banging on afterwards, saying, right, Golovkin, make sure you answer your phone tomorrow. We're going to be calling you first thing to organise this fight. It wasn't like the moment when we realised that Mayweather and Pacquiao were going to go into negotiations and the fight... Look, really, for a few weeks it looked like it wasn't that kind of that happiness. And a few times a question was put to him, you know, is weight going to be an issue in terms of is the catch weight thing going to be an issue? And it was never really answered.
Yeah. Unless it's going to be a bargaining chip in the in the deal. Unless they're going to say, all right, we're going to go up to 160, but you have to, I don't know, give us more money or whatever.
Maybe. I mean, but come on, they're middleweights. Fight at the middleweight limit.
Alright, I'm down with that.
It's frustrating. It's frustrating. You can't, and this again, and kind of, I was talking in defence of the WBC before, but this is a point where the WBC could get involved and say, look, hang on a minute, you fight for the WBC middleweight title. Marvin Hagler's won it. Carlos Monzon has had it. These guys, these legends, they fight at 160. This is what the middleweight division's about. It's 160. So therefore, you fight at 160 pounds, and that's it. There's no negotiation. There's no negotiation. Particularly now that we're talking about Gennady Golovkin, who would be the rival. You could almost forgive them for making 1-5, because without 155, let's face it, the Khan-Canelo wouldn't have happened. Cotto and Canelo wanted to fight at 155, so because it suited all parties in those two fights, you can say, okay, well, all right, we'll do it. But now we're actually fighting middleweights, then you fight the middleweight limit. And if you're not comfortable with it, go back down to light middleweight and carry on with your career there.
I'm convinced. So, what should Khan do next?
I would like to see him take a year out. And, you know, I think we may have spoke about it the last time. But you do wonder how his body will cope with being taken back down to 147. Okay, he's not old, he's not a veteran, but he's been going for his professional career is over 10 years now.
And there have been hard fights as well.
And there's been some hard fights in there. So I'm not convinced that going back down to welterweight would be beneficial for him or his punch resistance. And he was talking afterwards, there's absolutely no need for him now to take a dip in terms of his level of opponent. The guys he mentioned were Tim Bradley, Manny Pacquiao, and Danny Garcia. He wants to go in with that level of opponent. I just think it might be sensible perhaps to go down to a non-title fight, weigh about 150, a 10 round. I'm not saying go in with someone who's levels and levels below him, but just kind of take a sensible step before taking a leap back up to these big, the really, really big names, and just see if his body's comfortable with it. See if his body's comfortable with it, because that would be my concern, is that he's not the fighter he was if he loses a lot of weight between now and December. And I know in the great scheme of things 8 pounds isn't loads, but he's got to change his body again and that kind of thing, and have quite a strain.
Yeah.
Can't it? We've seen it so many times with fighters who drop in weight.
Yeah, what you say, like dropping back down in weight after, you know, a horrible knockout like that. You've got to worry about his sort of resilience after that. You know, do you think he should be just steered clear from big punches now?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the arguments for kind of take. So I can't remember who I was talking to. Somebody said, well, that's kind of the beauty of Timothy Bradley, is that he's not a huge puncher. But I think if we're in that kind of territory, and we, you know, these things have been thrown about with Amir Khan for so long now that he can't take a punch, where he has shown in the past that he can.
Yeah.
But if you're in territory where you shouldn't be in with big punches, then frankly you shouldn't be in boxing. So I don't think that's something that people should be saying too much about Khan.
Yeah. But then, would I don't know how you would have picked Khan, how you would have seen Khan versus Kell Brook going before the Canelo fight, but would your view on the outcome of that change now?
Yeah, it would do now, yeah. I mean, of course I've given the fight a lot of thought because the whole thing fascinates me, but I've never actually looked down at it from and really analysed it and come out with a winner. I suppose my instinct probably leaned towards Brook, and now if the fight was made for December, I'd probably favour Kell Brook more than before. I just don't think it's wise for Khan to go straight back in with someone at that level. I'm not saying he couldn't do it. I'm not saying he wouldn't win. I just think it would be wise just to take him back gently after a knockout like that, because if you don't, then you really are in career-ending territory. You really, really are. And, you know, he was asked about Kell Brook afterwards, and he just dismissed it out of hand. Just, I don't like him, don't want to fight him. And I think a lot of that may have been kind of Kell Brook's tweet, which he's since tweeted about himself, Amir Khan, in that literally I think when he was on the floor receiving treatment, Kell Brook tweeted him and said, "Come on then, let's have a fight at 147, which, from Amir Khan's point, I don't suppose Kell Brook was trying to be, I don't know.
Well, maybe Kell, maybe, you know, to put it, to think of it kindly, maybe Brook's thinking, okay, now he's lost that fight, he can come back to England and we can get on the big British fight that was put on hold for Canelo. But obviously it's come across as, you know, taking a pop at a man when he's down.
Yeah, so, Khan has dismissed that out of hand. I would say this time next year and Khan has won a comeback fight, then, and a load of money is thrown at him, you know, never say never. When these guys say I'm not doing it, that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. So, you know, we'll see with that one. But I do come away from, I always thought it would happen. Now I don't. I just don't think we'll see it. I think either Khan is genuine in his fact that he's not gonna fight Kell Brook. He doesn't want to be involved in a fight with him. He really dislikes him. He doesn't want to give him the opportunity to earn millions and millions and millions. And or Khan will lose another fight and his career will effectively be over.
I've got the solution for what Amir Khan should do next.
Go on and hit me.
At welterweight, how do you feel about Amir Khan versus Adrian Broner?
Yeah,
it's a big fight. Broner doesn't really carry his power up to welterweight. High profile.
Shouldn't this be someone that Kell Brook's looking at, Adrian Broner?
It should be.
That'd be a good fight.
But they're talking about what, Brook, Vargas, or possibly Bradley or whatever.
Yeah, we spoke to Jesse Vargas when he was out there. When I was out there, he actually lives in Las Vegas. That's looking like a possible.
But just because Broner's notorious, everyone wants to see him. But
Broner Brook would be a good one, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but I just think surely Khan Broner is more likely because aren't both advanced by Al Haymon.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
It's getting tricky for Brook to get the big fight he needs because, you know, Amir Khan hasn't won them all, obviously, but he has had big name after big name in his career, and Brook sort of, you know, he desperately needs that, really.
The thing is with Jesse Vargas is that, okay, so he's got WBO belt, it's a unification fight, but say if that's a pay-per-view, that's still an incredibly tough sell, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You know, who's Jesse Vargas?
Yeah, because like, I think for a pay-per-view fight, it needs to, you know, it needs to break out from just, you know, it needs to reach out to sports fans, not only as well as boxing fans. So it may be a good fight, and it makes sense as a world title unification fight. But if they're going to pay a fortune to get Vargas over, is Brook Vargas big enough? You know, maybe something like Anthony Joshua undercard.
Well, yeah. Yes. Okay, so is there anything else you want to say about Khan and Brook and Canelo before we move on?
I just hope they're all happy. Those are my thoughts on the matter. Why can't everyone get along, Matt?
It's a good question, isn't it?
We've been rattling on for half an hour.
I know, we should maybe move on to other events.
All right.
Anthony Crolla. Anthony Million Dollar Crolla. The feel-good story continues. There was a moment from ringside in Las Vegas where there was some British guys from the British media huddled round a screen, kind of punching the air as Anthony Crolla won. it's you kind of wonder what else he can do. You almost now kind of want him to stop because it would just be, it's just a perfect ending, it isn't is. It?
Yeah. It is a Hollywood story.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And it's surely it will just be called Million Dollar Chrono, right?
Yeah.
But how much of an inspiration is somebody like Anthony Crawler, who early on in his career, he lost a couple of fights. Okay, he was at a good level.
Well,
but never in a million years would he be thinking to be at world level.
Yeah, on Monday, so I was up there to do a few interviews, so I did a long interview with Crawler on Monday and was grilling him about losing to Yusuf Al-Hamidi in his career. It was mad to think he lost to him, who's a journeyman, and what, like, Crawler was justifying it as well, but he was not a good journeyman. And he's lost to him and gone on to become, you know, not just a world champion, arguably the best lightweight in the division, arguably. But probably he's got the best track record of any lightweight in the division when you look at everyone he's beaten. Mental. Been hit over the head by burglars while saving his neighbour's Christmas.
I know. It is. It is a fantastic story, and you know, he's heard it millions of times. It's been said a million times. But he's a genuinely, genuinely lovely human being as well, isn't he?
Yeah. I remember one of the first time I went up to Gallagher's gym, it was like just before that he fought John Watson for the British title, and I'd actually done the preview in the magazine and picked John Watson to win. So I was thinking, oh no, I'm going to go there and everyone's going to, like, you know, I don't know, be angry at me or something. But you know, Crawler was perfectly pleasant.
Crawler, yeah, he's. I mean, what? There's a lot of talk now about Terry Flanagan. Frank Warren made it clear that he would be happy to be kind of co-promoter of a Sky Sports box office event, and kind of has now given the ball to Eddie Hearn, as it were. Can you see it happening, first of all? Can you see it happening?
There still seems to be a lot of hurdles, because even if, yeah, like, I don't know how that would work, like co-promoting a Sky Sports box office event. I don't know if Sky would go for that or what. And isn't there the problem in that Crawler Flanagan is a good fight? I'd like to see it. It's a good story, but is it a pay-per-view fight? You know, not every good fight it has to be a pay-per-view event. And is Crawler Flanagan going to generate enough money to bring, you know, rival promoters together to share the same platform? I don't know. Will they be able to agree on the way they sort of split the spoils, and that won't Team Crawler say, you know? I'm sure Flanagan's team would dispute it, but Crawler's team will say, you know, he's the draw. He you know, puts more bums on seats, etc. Obviously, Flanagan's team will, you know, argue against that. But then you can just see a lot of arguments with actually getting the fight made. And it's not the only good fight in the lightweight division. Like Crawler and Nares is good. Any of the unifications are good, really. But I would like to see it happen. I would like to see Flanagan Crawler happen eventually. I'm not sure it's big enough right now for it to be made in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fight I'd love to see. It's a fight I'd love to see, but I'm not convinced. And I could be completely wrong, and if anybody's listening and they want to kind of get in touch with us, then please do so. But I'm not convinced that this is big enough for pay-per-view, for many of the reasons you've just said. I think if you compare it to Quigg Frampton, which have been bubbling for a few years, I think even something like James DeGale, George Groves too, even though I'd rather be ringside for Crawler Flanagan, But even something like De Gale Groves too, you could probably make more of an argument that would appeal to the masses.
Yeah.
And that's what you need. The hardcore may buy it, but then you need to draw in as well to some of the more casual fans who'll have a passing interest and will be drawn in by the rival, be drawn in by the story. And, you know, we mentioned that Anthony Crolla is a real lovely, lovely guy, but you can't imagine, for example, Flanagan and Crolla having the kind of shenanigans beforehand or the kind of bad-tempered press conferences that, sadly, in this day and age, you need that.
Yeah.
When you haven't got the household names involved, Scott Quigg and Carl Frampton, again, they're not, you wouldn't say they were massively famous in the grand scheme of things, but at least they had that very, very real bitter rivalry. And okay, Crolla and Flanagan used to go to the same school, but is that enough? And are they going to really? I don't know. I'm just not convinced that it would be. It would need to be a pay per view event as opposed to a pay per view fight.
Yeah. Because like, surely hardcore fans want to see it. You know, proper boxing fans will want to see it, but will they really want to have to see it on pay per view when, you know, it costs enough to get all the, you know, to get all the boxing channels where you don't miss anything?
I mean, this is the thing, and I completely understand the business model of they need to do so many things on. And I understand, as much as it pains me, I understand why probably Anthony Joshua is going to, from now until till he loses or to the end of his career, whichever comes first, he's going to be on pay per view.
Yeah,
but you can understand that because he has got the whole nation interested in him.
Yeah, well, he's an Olympic gold medalist and he's knocking these guys out. People do love that.
Yeah,
but they still need to make the undercards. You know, they still need to stack the undercards with good fights.
Of course they do.
Make worth the money.
Of course they do. Of course they do. I mean, I don't think we spoke about Dominic Brazil on here, but you know, I made it clear in editorial that I thought that fight was. I'm not a fan, I thought it was awful, quite frankly. But anyway, we're not talking about that now. We're talking about Crolla and Flanagan, and it would just be nice to see something like this. Just okay, well, let this one slip. We'll have this without pay per view. But then again, you could, because I think that with the Crolla fights we've had recently, Crolla Perez, Crolla Barroso. Yeah, they're solid fights that didn't make it onto the pay-per-view platform. So maybe do it again with Flanagan. I'm just not convinced that it's that big. I think every boxing fan, every British boxing fan, would have it towards the top of their wish list. But is it something that would cross over and you would regard it as a super fight? And I think for pay-per-view events, they have to have a bit of that, or they have to have a superstar involved.
Yeah.
And it doesn't tick either of those boxes for me.
Because if they're not going to be super fights or not have superstars, then where will it stop? Everything will be on pay-per-view.
Yeah. Okay, so what else was going on at the weekend? Derek Chisora went loopy the day before his fight and then lost. Was it the day before, 2 days before?
Kind of both. They had a bit of a push and a pull at a press conference, and then he had a major Hulk out. he left it all at the weigh-in, unfortunately. The Kubrat prelim really won that fight, clearly.
Yeah, he did, and that was, I mean, we mentioned the score in, and I speak about this in the column this week, in this week's Boxing News, which is, by the time you listen to this, it should be available on the newsstand. If not, download it digitally. It's packed this week, lots of good stuff in there. But I did talk about the whole judging thing with the Chisora Pulev, which was just like, what the hell is this dude doing with that scoreline where he gave, he would have given Chisora 7 rounds and Pulev 5. Is that right? Yes, it is, 115, 113.
I can't count, man.
So it would be seven rounds to 5, which, you know, I didn't watch it. I think you watched it live. I didn't watch it live. I did watch it when I got back from Las Vegas. And I just, it was a bad card.
Yeah, and Derek wasn't even the home fighter. He was the.
Well, this
fighter.
Is the thing. This is the thing that almost makes it even more suspicious. It was. I know. It was just. It was odd. It was a very, very strange decision. But then didn't Malik Scott say Chisora won that by 3 or 4 points?
Did he say that?
He tweeted something like that, yeah. Well, so maybe it's us. Well, maybe we've got it completely wrong.
Who are we to argue with Malik Scott?
Chisora now. It was a brave old fight going out to Hamburg. Shame he went nuts yet again on foreign soil. I really liked Chisora Joshua. I'm not saying I'd have picked Chisora to win it, but I just thought Joshua right now, that's a perfect fight for him.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That was perfect for, like, you know, before Joshua fought for a world title, European title, European heavyweight title fight against Joshua Derek Chisora. That's, you know,
yeah,
big.
But even now he's lost. But even, I mean, he's better than Dominic Brazil.
Yeah.
He would have been a better opponent for Dominic. Not now he's coming off a loss. But this is what I'm saying. Whereas previously you'd think, well, okay, we can still make that fight with Chisora. Chisora will sell. He's an interesting character. But now you feel, now he's lost to Pulev, which, despite what the cards say, it was fairly convincing. It was a convincing loss. He struggles with these big, tall guys. He took that quite a nasty beating, really, in the end against Tyson Fury. And now, all of a sudden, I think he's kind of gone from contender, fringe contender, and he's at gatekeeper level now. He's rapidly approaching stepping stone.
Yeah.
And he's what, 32? So you kind of think, well, that's it really for Chisora. But I suppose this is heavyweight boxing, a couple more wins. World ranking says, here you go, pal. World governing body goes, here you go, pal.
Yeah.
And you just don't know, do you?
Exactly. Or David Price, something like that.
Maybe.
Winner of that would sort of get themselves.
But again,
the mix.
But he's still at that gatekeeper level. I think he's regressed to gatekeeper now.
Because it was him who chose the Pulev fight. He had the option. He had the offer of fighting Joshua, maybe not for as much as what Chisora thought he was worth. But I think he backed himself to beat Pulev and then, you know, bring even more to the table and get even more to then fight Joshua. So he took, you know, he took a risk, he took a gamble, but it just didn't pay off.
I think in terms of aesthetically, in terms of his physique, that's one of the best I've seen Chisora look against Pulev. He looked like he really, really put some hours in.
Yeah, because he has looked quite fleshy in the past against Fury. He didn't look great, but he did look in good nick.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, I think I spoke to him briefly. I'm trying to think what it was. It was at that dinner with Floyd Mayweather thing, and Chisora was there. And yeah, you did sense that he felt that he had the beating of Pulev.
And
he was going to go off and he didn't think that he was getting enough for fighting, you know, the biggest star in British boxing at the moment. But you just wonder now if that fight will happen and what's in the future for Chisora, because he's going to have to take quite a step down in his earnings. But yeah, Price Chisora, no, you're absolutely right. I hadn't thought of that. That's a good option for both of them. And that's just David Price back on May 29, isn't he? He's at the Goodison Park show.
Yeah.
To see how he looks. Because some of the American guys out in Las Vegas actually were kind of lauding. They were just envious of the British heavyweights that we've got over here.
As well they should.
Because we have. You've got Fury, Joshua, and Hay, which you could. Certainly Fury and Joshua, you can say now they're at world level. Hay, I think, is still to prove himself in this stage of his career. And then you have got the likes of Price and Chisora, Dillian White, who are at that level below. And it's pretty strong if you just name those six names, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, Brazil, he's probably the best American heavyweight prospect. In that he's their Olympian.
But that's it though, isn't it?
Oh yeah, and I believe Joshua is gonna, you know, crush him.
Yeah, so do I. Okay,
but
so
I think that, but you know, does it, other than Wilder, do America have any
particularly good heavyweights to offer. Like, we've got heavyweights, Britain's got heavyweights all over the place. Wilder's pretty much the only one carrying the torch for the USA, and fighting Povetkin in Russia is not easy.
No, I mean, hopefully we'll talk again before that, but we have, speaking of the heavyweight division, not this weekend coming, but the one afterwards, it's a big, big weekend for the division, isn't it? You've got, like you mentioned, Deontay Wilder, really, really should get a lot of credit for going over to Russia to take on, to defend his title against Povetkin. Money talks, of course. He's not doing it for free. He's not doing it without reward. But it does show that, I think it shows a lot of belief there. And then, of course, over in New Zealand, you've got Joseph Parker against Carlos Takam in an IBF eliminator.
I'm looking forward to that one. I want to see Joseph Parker against someone decent.
Well, this is it. I mean, the thing is as well, okay, here's a question for you, and I know you're a massive Joshua fan, but if Joseph Parker beats Carlos Takam convincingly inside five rounds, should he be ranked in independent ratings above Anthony Joshua?
I wouldn't say so. Was Takam particularly highly ranked?
Takam has been, bottom half of top 10 for quite a long time.
Oh, maybe in that case. So the argument would be, has Joshua beaten anyone better than Takam? Yeah, I can see that argument. Though I think Joshua sort of, he's destroyed some guys who should have... He's destroyed his gatekeepers in style, which would probably account for like a high rating. But I can see that argument. But I think Joshua is better than Parker. But yeah, but if you're strict, if you're strictly doing your rankings on what they've done rather than their potential, then maybe. But it's just that Glaskov was pretty highly ranked as well, because Martin beat him. If you think Martin was going to on course to win that fight, which was my first impression whilst watching it live. And then Joshua, squashed Martin easy, I'd probably stick him higher in the rankings. But I think if Parker comes through against Takam, I think that's a good fight. I hope Joshua fights him sort of next after Brazil.
Yeah, it would be because it'd be mandatory then.
Yeah.
And the only way you'd be able to get out of that was if there'd be some kind of unification.
Like the Fury fight but I want to see this Parker fight because I don't know much about Parker. Like, how old is he? Early 20s?
Yeah,
like 23? 24. Sorry, because that's what I'm wondering about. I'm wondering, why wasn't Parker at the Olympics? Because of the 2012 Olympics? Because he was from New Zealand, so he would have been in the Oceania qualifier, which was New Zealand and Australia, and that's not a strong boxing region. Like, there's a reason Australia had a full team at the last Olympic Games. It wasn't that they were good, it's just the qualifying they had to beat Kiribati in New Zealand and these kind of non-boxing powerhouses. So why didn't Joseph Parker qualify for the Olympic Games?
Because he didn't want to.
is that why?
Yes. He didn't want to. He didn't want to go to the Olympics. We don't all love the Olympics, John.
No.
No, I hear you. I know what you're saying.
So that's what I mean. From what I've seen of him as a pro, he's looked good. Is he fundamentally good?
It's a big jump. I've been impressed with him. It's a big jump. It is a big jump, though, Takam. And I agree with you as well. I'd like to see Joshua then fight the winner and really let the super fight build.
Yeah.
Because then I think the winner of Parker Takam, you can then say once Joshua has beaten the winner of that fight, then okay, let's really, really start to believe that this guy.
Yeah, I think that's the step up fight.
Yeah,
it's a bit
sad to say that he's already world champion and he still needs a step up fight, but that's kind of the way it is at the moment, and that's the way of the boxing world, I'm afraid.
And also Martin should have been better than he was. Martin was kind of unknown, and he put in a pretty poor show in April. Like, you know, he gave Josh a less hard fight than Dylan White.
Yeah.
For, you know, a reigning champion, Martin should have given it more of a go.
And then we got David Haye
against Arnold, the Cobra.
The Cobra, who, from Kosovo, left there after the war.
He's the best boxer in the Switzerland, whole of Switzerland.
Arrived in Switzerland, had a tough time in Switzerland because he didn't know the language. That was as a child, and that's the last time he wept. Was when he was in Switzerland as a child.
Wow, how do you know so much about Arnold the Cobra? You're a pro.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't just been subbing our 60 seconds page before I came in here.
The last time he wept was Switzerland.
Was when he got to Switzerland after leaving Kosovo and realising he couldn't communicate with anybody. Couldn't speak the lingo.
When was the last time you wept?
He just broke down into it. The last time I wept. I'm not telling you.
That means it was recent.
It was. It depends if you're kind of watching a film and then you're just like, oh god, that caught me unawares, and there's a little tear in the eye.
It was watching a film,
or if it's a full-on weep. I'm not sure.
You shed a manly tear watching a film. It's up to me to guess which film.
No, I really don't.
My guess is Jerry Maguire.
No, it wasn't Jerry Maguire. It just took, and I didn't even like the film. Ooh. But it was okay. The film was okay, but I wasn't expecting what happened to happen quite so suddenly, and I was just like, whoa.
Okay, so is it like the Lego movie when at the end he steps out of the Lego world and you're like, this is so meta?
No, the incident occurred about 20 minutes into the 20 minutes after it started, maybe 25 minutes. It took me by, I don't even know if you've seen it, I don't know.
X-Men First Class?
No, not X-Men First Class.
Magneto sort of goes evil for the first time?
No.
You can tell me what it is, Matt.
I'm not just telling you, though, am I?
Yeah, but we all need to know.
It was Southpaw.
Oh, God, I haven't even seen Southpaw.
Yeah, well, be warned, my friend. It's not a smooth ride.
How drunk were you when watching
this? I may have had a hangover. It was a Sunday. My girlfriend and I sat down and watched it. I went... But something happened in the first 25 minutes that I was not remotely expecting, and it took me by surprise.
This has taken me by surprise.
Okay, so that's 53 minutes. My reputation is in tatters. I think that... So, yeah, anyway, go back to David Haye. I mentioned earlier that Brazil was a bad opponent. So if Brazil's a bad opponent, in my opinion, I'm not you know, telling you the same, but if Brazil's a bad opponent for Joshua, then the Cobra is a almost unforgivable opponent for David Haye. What does it say about, and I suppose we will speak about this next week, but just while I've got the train of thought trundling along, what does it say about David Haye that he's gone for this fight? Does it say that he hasn't got any... He's going to keep fighting this kind of level of opponent until a really, really lucrative opportunity presents itself? Does he still feel that he needs to fight this level of opponent? Has he not got the confidence to go in with someone that he thinks might last 7 or 8 rounds?
Yeah.
I felt that he'd done this with Mark Dimori. I said it afterwards... But the Mark Dimori fight was forgivable after 3.5 years out of the ring completely. But then he's gone into someone who... You could make a case that he's a level below Dimori. Well, not a level, but he's not even... Dimori was a no one almost, but this guy's even worse.
Yeah. Like, does he have so much ring rust after 3.5 years out that he needs...
But how much ring rust is he going to shake while blasting somebody else out and around?
Yeah. Or maybe it's, yeah, you're right. Maybe it's a purely financial decision in that
he has, you know, he's a former world champion, he has fought, you know, quality people in the past, so he doesn't have anything he needs to prove, and that all he needs is a spectacular knockout to help sell a bigger fight against, you know, to make him look like, you know, yeah,
to help sell a bigger fight against Joshua or whoever. But then, if the master plan is for him to fight Shannon Briggs before the end of this year, that's a pretty poor year. Two randoms and a very elderly, in boxing terms, Shannon Briggs.
Briggs could lose his next fight, couldn't he?
Hadn't David A matched him harder than he's matched himself?
It's Dimitrenko, yeah. And I'm not sure what he's been like. I mean, I remember when he came up, he was kind of being touted for the very, very top. I think he lost to Eddie Chambers. But that was a huge upset at the time. That was Eddie Chambers at his peak. And okay, Eddie Chambers. But Briggs hasn't been in with anyone like this for... It was in a fight that in a non-title, okay, go back to the Vitali Klitschko fight 2010, and prior to that Sultan Ibragimov, which I think was 2007, and I wouldn't be surprised at all, unless they know something about Dimitrenko and the fact that he has gone back so far. He's got no ambition. It's a really really curious bit of matchmaking for someone like Shannon Briggs.
Yeah. No, it's an odd fight for Shannon Briggs to take, but then maybe it'll never happen.
Briggs has been doing all of his work sort of outside the ring, kind of promoting himself, and that's, you know, made it easy to forget that he is, what, 44, and not really, you know, he's someone who should be winding up his career, not trying to get a fight with a big name like David Hay.
And we've said all that just to kind of look at it from the other point of view as well, and Briggs has also been, he's faced nothing but criticism for not fighting anyone. So fair play if that fight does happen, and he does actually prove that he does deserve to be somewhere in and around these big fights. I'm not saying Dimitrenko does that, by the way, but it's a step up at least, and I think that was required, and perhaps something like that was, you know, people behind the scenes may have said, look, if you're going to fight him, David, you can't have him knocking over some bum on your undercard. He needs to prove that he can survive in a fight with you, and perhaps Dimitrenko is fulfilling that.
Yeah, but then maybe if he loses to Dimitrenko, that's better than him getting, you know, smashed by someone of the quality and power of David Hay.
Yeah, okay, so it's true. All right, well, let's leave it at that. We've been going on now for nearly an hour. And a lot has been said.
I'm still reeling from Southport Gate.
Just don't watch it, John. It's not worth it. It's just, I didn't particularly enjoy the film. I would never watch it again.
You can see it through your salt tears. But
that moment in the first half an hour, phew.
I know how you feel. I was like that when watching Inception. When you're like, oh my God, the little windmilly thing, it's in the safe. That was a special moment.
It's more shocking than that. Anyway, thanks everybody for your support. Please do pick up a copy of the magazine from newsagents, or download one digitally. Let us know what you think about it. Also, everything is being updated on the website, www.boxingnewsonline.net, and we will be back soon.